We missed the Revelation study last week because Todd and Amanda, they were here and had an enjoyable time with them. We are still back in Revelation chapter 11. There are some things that, as we study this chapter, I do want to go back and touch base on a little bit. We have said, when we look at the book of Revelation, as far as an overall meaning of the book, remember that John is giving Christians a picture of what they have. You know, if you're living the Christian life, and these are some of the things that you have, these are some of the things that you should expect. And he sometimes also deals with non-Christians. We talked about that as far as some of the consequences people have when they choose to live the non-Christian way of life. So John has a lot of information about Christianity. He receives this information through various visions. In Revelation chapter 12, which we're not there yet, but if you want to skip across the page just a bit, to show you how inclusive he is as far as talking about things relative to Christianity, beginning with Revelation 12:2, and she was with child. Who do you think the child refers to? All right, I believe that's correct. All right, and she crieth out, travailing at birth, and the pain is to be delivered. And then you've got in verse 3, there was seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns. Who do you think that is? All right, the devil. And upon his head, 7 diadems. And his tail draweth the third part of the stars from heaven, and then did cast them down to the earth. And the dragon stands before the woman that's what? About to be delivered. Well, if the child refers to the Lord, and John says that the devil was, you know, standing there prior to the time the child was being delivered, where does that take you to as far as time? Well, okay, it has to take you prior to the coming of Jesus into the world, doesn't it? Satan's there ready to devour the Lord. So when you think about Revelation 12, to kind of give you an understanding, I guess, or at least, I guess understanding is the best word, an understanding of what I'm trying to present, John has a lot of information about Christianity in Revelation, in this particular book, and even some information that would be leading up to the gospel era, as we'll see from chapter 12. All right, some other things, just kind of a quick highlight. You remember back in Revelation 1, John has said that Jesus is standing among his people, standing among the candlesticks and the lampstands. Revelation 2 and 3, God's people are going to go through some good things and some bad things as they live their lives. And in Revelation 6, John had used some information. There was a vision there that talks about persecution. We saw that with the black horse. He talked about with the seals that we're going to face death. And we're going to face all kinds of other things. So just a real good summary of a lot of the things that have taken place and continue to take place throughout the Christian era. All right, now that kind of brings us to where we left off in Revelation 11. And I want to go back and recap some of the verses so we'll be up to speed when we come to verses 9 and 10. We talked about the reed. Think of that as a tool to measure. And he says there that this reed was used to measure what? The temple of God. And how do we define the temple of God? God's people, the church, us. All right, and then he says there were some folks outside the temple. They were in the court. We said that's still true today, isn't it? There are people, they're not in the church, but they're close. And those people could be hypocrites. You know, maybe they've got the truth, they're just not obeying it. Maybe it's someone who attends worship on a regular basis, but they are, you know, not in the church, if you will, because they've not been obedient to God. But there are people who were in the court. Then John talks about opposition at the end of Revelation 2. He said it was given unto the nations that they should take the holy city, that would be God's people, the church, and that they should tread them underfoot, how long? 40 and 2 months. Not a literal amount of time, but a time to say that it was going to be a period of great difficulty for God's people. And then God talked about two witnesses, his people, they were going to be able to prophesy, and that was a way of saying that it was going to be a tough time for them, clothed in sackcloth, clothing that would represent mourning, but still his people were going to prevail. The Lord of the earth, Revelation 11, verse 4, would be a reference to deity, and God said, you know, I'm there with my people, and things are going to be okay. And then in 5 and 6, he said, if anybody tries to hurt my people, are they going to fare very well? No. They're going to have some serious issues. God's very watchful over his people. And then in verse 7, this kind of brings us to where we left off 2 weeks ago. And when they, that would be God's people, shall have done what? They shall have finished their testimony. What do you think he's talking about here? We're talking about the church, Christians, when they finish their testimony. All right, we've taken God's word. How far and wide? All right, we've taken it all over. And God said when that time came, then what was going to happen? There was going to be a beast. And that, of course, would be the devil and presumably his helpers that was going to come out of the abyss. And we've talked about the abyss. That would be the place where Satan and his assistants are held for a while. And war. War was going to be made with them. Who have been talking about? The Christians, the church, God's people. And this war was going to be a very bad war. In fact, as you look at the end of verse 7, it says that this war was going to overtake God's people and actually kill them. And then their dead bodies were going to be in the streets, and not literally, but as far as trying to stamp out Christianity, there was going to be at least one time, and that's kind of where we stopped, and maybe other times, but at least one time when God said the gospel will have gone forth into the world, and there's going to come a time where things are not going to be looking so hot for the church. And then in verses 10 and 11, and they that dwell on the earth, those of course would be those opposed to God's people, they're going to rejoice over them and make merry. And they shall send gifts one to another because these two prophets tormented them that dwell on the earth. And after the 3 days and a half, the breath of life from God entered into them. And they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them that beheld them. And that's kind of where we left off. Now, I want to say some things about the, I don't know if you'd call it persecution, but what took place as far as God's people and the difficulty described here. And to do that, I want to review some church history. We know pretty much what things were like up until about 100 AD. We've got Jesus, you know, around 30 AD coming into the world. He does his public ministry for about, you know, 3.5 years, so we're now up to about 33 AD, about when the church was established. All right, you then have for the next 70 years, the apostles, they're preaching, they're teaching. God's word is being revealed little by little. And up until about 100 AD, things, you know, you've got some problems in some congregations, but up until about 100 AD, things work pretty well. But it's like anything else. You see somebody that establishes a business, first generation, things are pretty good. Second generation comes along, and what often happens? You don't have the same commitment. Things are loosened up, and there are some difficulties. And if the businesses survive into third and fourth generations, you can often have some really serious issues. And that's what we find. For example, we think about the leadership in Christ's church. Acts 14:23 says elders in every church. But after you get past the first century, that begins to change a little bit. We've got bishops outside of a local congregation. They're beginning to arise, and now you've got a bishop over multiple congregations, a single man. And then there were some other practices that began to crop up little by little. You've got ministers being described with words like reverend, words not found in the Bible. And then by the time you get to about 248, about 150 years after the close of the first century, you've got the papacy. You've got papal supremacy becoming an issue, so it didn't take very long. By the time you get to the fourth century, you have some other issues, and people coming up with some strange things. There are some indications that in the fourth century, they were baptizing people naked. Now, they didn't, you know, men were baptizing men, and women, you know, were either being baptized in the dark or separate. But that is something that you don't find in the New Testament. But to let you have an understanding of just how far off people were getting, and to kind of give you a picture of maybe what John was describing here in Revelation chapter 11. Then you move about 200 years past the time when the first century closed. This would be about 313 to 787. And for these 400 years, you've got this religious apostasy. It's beginning to build and grow and amplify in all kinds of ways. And here are some of the false doctrines that are beginning to increase. You've got infant baptism. You have original sin. You have the doctrine of penance. This, of course, would be the idea that you inflict punishment on yourself to make up for your sins. You have praying to Mary. There was praying to the saints. You've got baptism by sprinkling. You have performing the sign of the cross, the introduction of priests to administer the Lord's Supper. You have confessionals, last rites, celibacy. You have the introduction of instrumental music and worship. Once again, referring to religious leaders by titles such as father, pope, priest, and so forth. You have the quote-unquote clergy lady. You have the preachers dressing differently than the people who come together to worship. You have an earthly headquarters for the church. You have the kissing of the pope's feet. And then papal power becomes such a power. You've got the mixture of secular and religious politics that you have in the Middle of Ages, this statement. Further, we declare, say, define, and pronounce that it is absolutely necessary for the salvation of every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff. Now, you imagine getting to a time where you have a power, the Catholic Church, that has arisen, that says every human being needs to be subject to Rome. What have you done as far as New Testament Christianity? It looks like you've stamped it out. It looks like you've replaced it with something else. Now, maybe this isn't what John describes, but it sure seems, and there may be a time in the future which is as bad or maybe worse. But you get to, as you look at church history, you get to a time where the simplicity that we find in the New Testament really seem to disappear. Other things, holy water, the canonization of the saints, fasting on Fridays, the celibacy of the priesthood, the rosary. We've got the sale of indulgences. As you go back and you look at church history, you see transubstantiation. This is the idea that the body and the blood of Christ actually are now what you are eating and drinking. You've got confessing sins to a priest. You have people being told they can't have the Bible. If they want to know anything, then they have to come to the quote-unquote church. You've got purgatory. You've got the sacraments. You've got people adding to the Bible, at least trying to do that with the so-called apocryphal books. You have the Pope, he's telling people that he's infallible. You've got all these different doctrines that have been introduced. Now, early in my preaching career, I've had some teachers, and if you go back and you look at some preaching that was done probably 50, 80 years ago, there were some people who were really hard on the Catholic Church. At least that's what I thought. I thought that they were too hard. But my view on Catholicism has evolved over the last 25 or 30 years. When you go back and you look at history and you see what Catholicism has done, and I'm not trying to beat up on the Catholics, but history is history. And as you go back and you begin to look at what this religious group has done, I think that those guys that were preaching this stuff 50, 100 years ago were absolutely right. When you think about Catholicism, one of their goals has been to have universal spiritual power. What I just read as far as the quote was, everybody needs to be subject to the pontiff. And when you look at Catholicism, you also have claims and a desire for worldwide temporal power. And all the things that I listed, and I didn't go through them all, but when you begin to heap all these various doctrines, you know, the information about the priests and the information about transubstantiation and penance, and you've got literally dozens of errors, what do you do to truth as far as New Testament Christianity? You saddle the people with all this information. You try to get the Bible out of the hands of people, and if folks want information, they go to the priest. And what have you done with the true church? You've basically shut it down. You've eliminated it. God's people have gone underground. And that seems to be exactly what John is describing here. Today, you look at Rome. They talk about the Vatican. What's the Vatican? All right, it's the governing body. It's basically the administrative center for the Catholic Church. And we know it's located in Italy. But anybody else remember? It's located there, but it's also considered to be a sovereign... It's considered to be a sovereign state. Now, can you imagine a religious group that has enough power to be considered a sovereign state? And not only does it have that status, when we begin to look at it, it's got diplomatic relations with the United States. When the Pope speaks, people listen. Now, they don't always heed what he says, but they do give him at least a little attention. Diplomatic relations with other countries. The Pope is regarded as the supreme bishop, the head of state, and most of us, who's heard that the Catholic Church claims to be the original church? All right, at least half of us have heard that claim, and that is, you know, a pretty potent claim. As we look at it, we see the cathedrals, the mysterious practices, the robes, the crowns, and all of that helps create this air of religious authority, religious supremacy, if you will, religious authenticity. We've got the so-called sacraments, the seven sacraments of the Catholic Church. So it really is a system, as we look at it, that has put a religion between God and man, right there. But when we look at the Bible, you remember who's between God and man? Christ. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 5. There's one mediator between God and man. So, like I say, John may not have had the Catholic Church in mind, but when you see, as far as the persecution, the apostasy, what it did, it lines up very, very well. And like I say, there may be other times in history, but John's describing a situation, and as we said, you've got various attempts throughout history to destroy the church. But Catholicism has done a really, really good job, especially when you go back several hundred years and see all the stuff that was done as far as keeping people in the dark. So I don't necessarily look at this as a prediction like, okay, at this particular point, this was going to happen, but it is a great, great illustration of what we have here in Revelation 11. All right, some hands popped up. I'll start to my left. Harvey, I think you were first. Glenda, and then Stan will take you.
To marry, which the Pope was committed to marry, yeah. And people were abstaining from certain things. Sure. You know, it seems like that could have been pointing at that.
Yeah. You would have to, I mean, unless he's pointing to a time that's apparently well beyond our time. I mean, you still have a little of that, but certainly Catholicism would be, five stars as far as the fulfillment of that, and not that far removed from the time of the Apostle Paul when you begin to go back and review some of this history. So, that would be absolutely consistent.
I think another thing, if I remember right, the Catholics at one time tried to destroy the Bible.
Yeah, they did, to basically go ahead and keep it out of the hands of people. So it's bad enough to saddle people with all that error, but then when you take away or try to take away the tool that will let you claw your way out of that, then you've just doubled your sin. And they have. I mean, I do not deny that they do, some charitable works. But when you go back and you look historically at what they've done religiously, they have been a huge, huge threat and problem. And I'd even go so far as to say a great tool of Satan. Now, they would be infuriated if you'd ever mention that, but they do fit the profile that we have here in Revelation 11. Glenda?
My mother-in-law spoke a little bit of Italian and Roman Catholic, so you know where that went. Anyways, what I wanted to say was a lot of the you talked about emperor worship and things like mm-hmm. that. The cardinals and all that are known as princes of the church. Mm-hmm. You know, like their royalty.
Yeah. And when you go back, and like I say, it's something that I don't study that often, but when you go back and you look at all the Catholic symbols and so forth, when you begin to see what they associate with those things, you step back and you say, wow, I never had a clue. But I mean, we're talking about some stuff when you look at it from a biblical perspective, even though it's a religious group, religious things, you have to say this is satanic. It is very, very wicked. And we just gave a quick overview and just didn't even scratch the surface of what they've done. But they have been a great enemy of truth.
So far, what John has been writing to these people has been pretty much based in their time, and it seems as if he's trying to, explain to them some of the things, some of the hardships, etc., that they're going to have to go through, but there's a certain amount of encouragement there, too, to hang in there, stick with it. It seems to me like chapter 11 is a continuation of that. What is there specifically that makes you think that now he's jumped from that time, that place, and that situation into the future? I don't see that in chapter 11.
Yeah. When we pick up with, let's see, you've got, if you start back there at the beginning, Stan, measuring the church and so forth, and then he talks about in verse 3, I'm going to allow my witnesses to prophesy 1,200 and 3 score days. So you've got the work of the church going on. And then in verses 5 and 6, he indicates that during this time, throughout the Christian era, there are going to be people who have the desire to hurt God's folks. And that's always been true throughout the Christian era. But then, after he talks about hurting God's folks, as you move down to verse 7, he talks about they're going to have finished their testimony. So you've got preaching going on. He says a time is going to come where that's been completed. So that statement has to be understood either specifically or generally, and I think you can kind of make a case for both. Throughout times, throughout time there have been occasions where it looked like, the gospel has pretty much gone throughout the world. But John says when they have finished this up, then you've got this beast coming out of the abyss. Was that going to be something that happened in the lifetime of these readers? Was that going to be something that happened a little bit later? He doesn't, specifically come out and say right when it was going to occur, but he does say that it was going to happen. And then you've got, as I said, the destruction that came from that, the spiritual destruction in verses 8 and 9. You've got the happiness over that as you look at verse 10. And then in verse 11, he says, and after the 3 days and a half, the breath of life from God entered into them again. So you've got this great spiritual war on God's people that it looks like it eliminates the church. And then after it looks like everything has been basically destroyed, God says they're going to come back. There's going to be a resurgence. Now, I think as you look throughout time, you can see that as far as several general examples of that. But another example that we are putting forward today would be what we have here with Catholicism and a lot of the other apostasy. As you look at that and you think about history, you have towards the end of that time, we've heard about the Protestant, remember that other word? Protestant Reformation. You have, after all this era, beginning in about the 15th and 16th centuries, you've got people like Martin Luther. When it comes, for example, to the Catholic Church, you remember what he tacked on the wall? The 95 Theses. He began to say, hey, there's some things like infant baptism that are not right. These things are not consistent with the Scripture. Now, because all that religious error had been placed upon people, it took a while for them to kind of claw their way out. It's like a guy who's down in the well. You know, it's going to take a little while to go ahead and dig your way back out. So they began, beginning with about 1517, lasting up until about 1800, and then you've got the so-called Restoration Movement after that. When you go back, Steve?
They're calling them Protestants because they're protesting against that error.
Yes.
That's where you get that term in the first place.
Yes. Yeah, and that's right. They begin to see the light a little bit as far as these things are not right. And then by the time you get to, the 19th century, you've got some things taking place with the church. And once again, this may not be exactly what John described. It certainly is consistent with it, though. Last 150, 200 years, you've got some people who are saying, let's go back to the Bible. Let's not have any additions or any subtractions to what we find. You had gospel meetings in all kinds of places, you know, throughout the U.S. and even some efforts in places like New Zealand, tent meetings, and a lot of times people would come to town, start preaching, and there would be a new congregation. By 1860, I went back and did some looking, by 1860, estimates are that there were 500,000 people in North America who had said, let's go back and let's follow the Bible. Let's not have any addition, let's not have any subtraction, no head but Christ. By the mid-20th century, there were an estimated 3 million people that were involved with New Testament Christianity. As you go back and you look at what's happened in the last 150, 200 years, out of all the religious groups that have published material, our folks within the Churches of Christ have really been at the forefront when it comes to various journals. Once again, to kind of help people come back to their biblical roots and make sure that we're following the Bible. Now, again, John may have had something else in mind, but when you go back and you look at religious history, it's at least one example of what we find here. But it does seem to be a shift, Stan. There are a lot of commentators that see Revelation 11 as a break. But I don't know that I'd necessarily see it as a break in the book, but it does. Like I say, and then when you look at chapter 12, we've got some information that he goes back and associates with Christianity, even before Jesus' birth. The visions do seem to shift a little bit as far as they're broadened some, but still, things related to Christianity. So I know it may not seem to be the smoothest transition. It seems a little bit rough, but he did talk about this period where there was going to be this great apostasy, and then the church rises again. So at least we can be assured of that much. Did you have a follow-up thought there?
If I did, it would sound argumentative, so it's just
one. Okay. All right. Anybody else?
I think nowadays, in our current time, the community churches are doing a lot of damage.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. And when you look at what we find here, you see, I think one of the big lessons for us, one of the key lessons would be that Satan wants to go ahead and keep people in religious error. He's always had that desire. And we're going to see, as we mentioned from Revelation 12 a little later, he had some desires to go ahead and keep people in error before Jesus came. And he's pictured as when the Lord came, you know, wanting to devour him, because he knew that that was going to be, you know, one more big part of God's plan to redeem man. And if he could eliminate that part, then that certainly was going to be helpful to him.
I think I've heard people make the statement that they're going to go to this particular church because the numbers are so great. great, we got it right. And that's a path to take. Just because there's numbers there doesn't mean that they're teaching the truth.
Yeah. No, Satan's...
People do that. They follow that kind of stuff because they think...
Yeah. Satan's tactics are across the board. Numbers, religious pageantry, you know, if it looks religious, you know, people today will do the same kind of thing. If something looks good based on the box, they'll buy it. And marketers oftentimes will spend a lot of money to research how to package something. You can have the best product in the world, but if it's not packaged right, people won't buy it. You know, it might cost 20% less to package it in a plain package. But people don't want plain packages. You know, they want something that from the get-go, it looks, hey, like I've got to buy it. So the devil's very, very good at that. Moving on a little bit, the true gospel is dangerous to Satan. It's often offensive to the world. When we think about our day and time, there was an article about a week and a half ago. I don't remember the hospital offhand, but it was a well-known place. I'm thinking it was Walter Reed. And they were talking about removing the Bible. The Bible's going to offend people. We've seen Bibles removed from hotels and motels because somebody, you know, may be offended if they open up the drawer and see the scriptures in there. But when we look at Satan, he's always had the desire that we see in Revelation 12, or Revelation 11, and then in 12:2, to destroy God's people. And then you also have this other element that we touched on. Not only do you have the desire to destroy, but you have the desire, or you have contempt from people. Again, Revelation 11, let's look at 9 and 10. And from among the peoples and the tribes and tongues and nations do men look upon their dead bodies 3 days and a half and suffer not their dead bodies to be laid in a tomb. Now, if this were literal, you would think that it's kind of an odd statement. Why look on dead bodies? They're generally not pleasant to look at, and especially if they're out there in the street. We might expect that from a hurricane or some other devastation, but I think the answer is based on the Old Testament. Let's go back and have a couple of verses read. One from Psalm 79, the other from the book of Jeremiah 22. We'll have a minute to get there. Steve, we'll ask you to pick up Psalm 79, verses 1 through 4, and then from Jeremiah 22, 18 and 19. Glenda, Jeremiah 22, verses 18 and 19. All right, if you're ready, Steve, Psalm 79, 1 to 4.
O God, the nations are coming to thine inheritance. The holy temple have they defiled. They have laid Jerusalem in heaps. The dead bodies of thy servants have they given to be food unto the birds of the heavens, the flesh of thy saints unto the beasts of the earth. Their blood have they shed like water round Jerusalem, and there have been none to bury them. We are become a reproach to our neighbors, a scoffing and derision to them that are around about us.
Okay, so here we've got a bunch of corpses. And then as you look at that verse, as you look at that fourth verse, what's said about them? We've become a reproach. We are something that's distasteful. And especially with this next reference, suggesting that people, when they hated someone, you know, even today, it's the same kind of thing. A guy beats up somebody, and after he's lying down on the ground, you know, he's bloody, he's bruised, he can't get up. The guy who did the beating, is he off calling 911? Hey, there's a guy that's lying down in the street. What's he do? He admires him. Look, he's been beaten. And that is the same picture that you have here in Psalm 79, plus in Jeremiah 22, and in Revelation chapter 11. We destroyed you. And it's kind of like, now what are you going to do? Absolute hate. Complete contempt for folks. Jeremiah 22. Once again, contempt. We don't have any respect. We don't value your life. And when we think about those who are opposed to God, his people, and the church, if they can knock the church out of existence, destroy a congregation, a local community, or as we've mentioned, what Catholicism did, you think they're going to be happy? They knocked out the good guys. So the answer is yes. Now, another quick point about this. John talks about this time. He says, they that dwell on the earth rejoice over them. They make merry. They're going to send gifts to one another. And then we'll come back to that in just a minute. But then in verse 11, and after 3.5 days. And And after the 3 days and a half, the breath of life of God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet. And then, of course, you have this great fear. Now, as you look at this and you contrast it with the information back there in verse 2, we see a difference. In verse 2, in the court which is without the temple, leave without and measure it not, for it hath been given unto the nations and the holy city that they should tread it under foot. How long? All right, you've got 42 months. And then down here, John revises the information just a bit. As you look at verse 9, we've got 3 days and a half. And then he uses days instead of months or years to apparently indicate that, as we've mentioned from verse 11, this is going to be a shortened time. It's going to be brief. It's not going to be continuous. As far as when the church seemed like it had been overthrown, God said, hey, it is going to happen, it is going to be bad, but do not think that this is going to be the end. But there would be a time, and as I said, it could be multiple times John is talking about, but there would be a time where people would make merry. They would be so happy that verse 10 says they're going to send gifts one to another. There are times where people are so enthused about something. Maybe somebody gets a new job, somebody moves into a new place, and a person will send a card or send a present. And here, when it looked like God's church had been completely overthrown, people were going to be happy. And then John also makes another point about this. He says, because, notice that word in verse 11 or 10, these two prophets tormented them that dwell on the earth. Now think about that. God's people, who are represented by these two prophets, they torment the unsaved, the people who dwell on the earth. How do God's people torment others? How do Christians torment the unsaved? Or the people who are religious but not religiously right?
Point out the truth.
All right. If you've talked to some people who are religious but not religiously right about things like baptism, worshiping on Sunday instead of Saturday, you usually don't get a very friendly, you know, friendly reception. When you think, for example, about Luther, when he nailed his 95 theses on the wall, what kind of reception do you think he got? Not a good one. And even if you talk about spiritual things to religious folks, or even if you're around, if you're well-known as far as a Christian, committed Christian, and you're around non-Christians, you think they get a little uneasy? You think they feel tormented? Oftentimes they do. There are things that they won't say. There are places that they won't go and do. And I'll tell you from a preacher's standpoint, and I appreciate when people do not introduce me as, well, hey, this is our preacher. I'm embarrassed by that. I'm not ashamed by that. But I'll tell you from a preacher's standpoint, if you're in my shoes and somebody says, well, this is our preacher, yikes. It's typically like they, you know, put their finger into an electrical socket and they just got jammed. I mean, it's kind of like, oh boy, what did I say? What am I going to say? Let's get away from this guy as quickly as we can. So when we find people who are either not religiously right or they are not living a Christian life, they do oftentimes feel tormented. And John said, well, you know, that's just going to happen. And once again, that's part of the Christian life. Peter, 1 Peter 3:16 talks about how non-Christians are sometimes made ashamed by God's people, and that is still true today. All right, anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with the next two verses, 11 and 12 in Revelation 11? Okay, let's move ahead a little bit. And after the 3.5 days, the breath of life of God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them that beheld them. And they heard a great voice from heaven saying unto them, come up hither. And they went up into heaven in the cloud, and their enemies beheld them. All right, as we've talked about, as far as the 3.5 days, that is a time. John uses the word days to emphasize, as with the 3.5, a time of persecution. He said there's going to be a period where things are not that great. In fact, it's going to be very bad. But the word days, in contrast to months or years, tells us that the persecution was going to come to an end. And he says, at the end of the spiritual darkness and persecution, and as we said, one example of that, as we look at history, would be the Restoration Movement, people coming back and turning to the Bible, beginning in probably about the 1800s, the breath of life of God would come back and Christians would stand upon their feet. So, as you look back there in verses 7 through 10, when it looked like Satan had overcome the church, we have the expression sometimes down but not out. And that's really what he seems to be describing here. There was going to be a time, And as I said, maybe multiple times when it looked like the, you know, God's people had been completely destroyed, but John said, hang in there, and you are going to recover from that. And as we look back at history, some of the names you may or may not be familiar with, but there were people back in the 19th century that helped revive New Testament Christianity. Some of them would have been James O'Kelly, Thomas Campbell, Elias Smith, Barton Stone, Amber Jones, Alexander Campbell, Walter Scott, Marshall Keble, a lot of others. People, as these preachers were preaching, heard the information, they were heartened, they were encouraged by what they heard, and they decided to become Christians. Now, as you have this taking place, people are going back to God, they're doing what the Bible says. What's the reaction on the part of some others? They're well, okay, but let's get it from the text. Let's read verse 11 again. And after the 3.5 days, the breath of life entered into them. They stood on their feet. You have the revival of God's people. You have the revival of the church. And then what's said? And great fear fell on those who beheld them. Now think about this, and as I said, this may not be the right explanation for it, but you think about the Catholic Church, for example. It has covered people with spiritual darkness and apostasy. Now when those rays of truth begin to shine, you think there was any fear? When people today are in power and it looks like they're going to lose their power, they're afraid. We see, for examples, with dictators. They do everything that they can to shut things down, to hold on, to keep their grip on power. So that would also be true of other religious groups as well. You see truth being taught and you find people coming out of religious groups, they're probably going to be terrified. Hey, who are these people? What are these people doing? Let's try to stop them. So John, as he talks about this particular time, makes this point as well. Let's see what else I wanted to give you. To kind of sum things up before we move a little more deeply, it seems to me as John's kind of talking about the Christian era throughout this book, we have, in some respects, in Revelation 11, sort of a summary throughout the Christian era. You know, we've got the apostasy that we have predicted by Paul. Harvey mentioned 1 Timothy 4 and some other passages. And then you have a time, and as I said, maybe multiple times, where it looked like the church was going to be stamped out. But God's people were going to be able to finish their testimony, the first part of verse 7. The gospel was going to make it throughout the world. John said things are going to get bad for a while. It looked like Satan was going to crush the church. And then God's people are going to spring back to life. And then you have here in verse 12 this additional information. And Stan, this kind of would go back to the point that you were asking about a little bit ago. And then they heard a great voice from heaven saying unto them, come up hither. If he's talking about the Christian era, when's that going to happen? God says to his people, to his church, come up. When's he going to do that? At the end of time. So that's one more reason for me to see this chapter as really kind of a summary of the Christian era. God's people are going to go through this. It looks like there's going to be a time when Christianity is going to be stamped out. It's going to come back to life. And then at the right time, God's people are going to be received up into heaven. Now, we don't know when that time is going to be, but we do have the promise of a future return where God is going to bring his people back. And then as we get down to verse 12 and also verse 13, we're talking about the sixth trumpet. Remember the seventh seal, the seventh trumpet, and the seventh plague. All these describe events after Jesus' return. But when we have the sixth seal, the sixth trumpet, and the sixth plague, which we're talking about right now, that brings us up until the end of time. So, as I said, that's one more reason for me to kind of see this as almost a snapshot of the entire Christian era. The good, the bad, and like I say, at the end of time, God says, if you prevail, you're going to be brought home with me in eternity. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we've said so far? Stan?
If that were the end of time, then why does the rest of the book even continue?
Well, we've got, when we think about the seals, the first six will take us up to the point where the Christian era comes to a conclusion. The seventh describes what would take place when the Lord returns. And John does that also with the seven trumpets and the seven seals. So here we're on number six, where he takes us up to that particular time. And that would be how I would interpret what we have in verse 12. It's now time to come home. And then he's going to pick up with the seventh trumpet to describe some of the things that will take place after the Lord returns. Scott?
Could this part of life be like Genesis, how they tell the beginning, and then they go back in Genesis, and then they like re...
summarize it again?
Could that be like...
Yeah. You do have here, I think, a summary of what Christians can basically expect, that, you know, you've got some success as far as getting the gospel out. There's also going to be at least one time where it looks like you're not going to do so well as Christians. It looks like it's going to be lost, but that faith is going to be revived, and at the right time, God will come back to reclaim his people. So it does, in some respects, go back and recap some of the things that we've already seen in the book. Steve?
Just in reading, in what I've read so far, it just seems like it loops back.
John does that.
It loops back, and it kind of covers, but as it goes through, it gives more information each time.
Yeah, and that's what I say. Remember, first six seals, first six trumpets, first six plagues, all dealing with things that are associated with the Christian era. But you have additional items, as you've mentioned. He recaps, and this isn't unique to John in Revelation. If you go back, and with 1 John especially, he'll cover some things, and then it's like he's through the first flight of stairs. He's going to go back and cover some things again, and you get some additional information. And then he's going to go back. Some preachers are sometimes told, tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them what you told them. And John kind of did that with his writing. So, but if people don't see that in this particular book, then they start trying to make, you know, predictions. Well, hey, you know, this is this time, and this is this period of time, and this is this particular. And I don't know that we've got, you know, very many of those in the book of Revelation. You have some things, as I say, you may have here some information about the Dark Ages, but still, in a very general way.
Which just seems to explain more, too, how that God's in control, and that, you know, he's working things in his own time.
Yeah. And as I said, in Revelation 12, if you go back and let's read those verses one more time, and then Glendale, take your hand. He says, and a great sign was seen in heaven. There was a woman arrayed with the sun and a moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was with child. All right, now, if Christ is the child, he's not yet at this point pictured as coming into the world. That being the case, how then would you understand this woman who's arrayed with the sun, the moon, under her feet, and she's got 12 stars? What's that sound like? Prior to Christ.
Sounds like things leading up to.
Exactly right. You've got the nation of Israel. Remember, God's organization of religion is symbolized by the number 12. So here he takes readers back to a time that was prior to Jesus coming into the world. Now that's new material as far as what we've studied thus far in the book of Revelation. But one more, it's like I say, going back and talking about the Christian era, but now he's going back from this additional perspective and saying, let me give you some more information. So it's a little difficult when he starts introducing the new stuff to kind of wrap your head around it. But that's why I said, in chapter 11, my thinking is, and I could be wrong, but my thinking is that this is kind of a general summary. And John offers that additional point. Glenda?
After he was speaking to the seven churches, he said, come up here in chapter 4, verse 1, and I will show you things still to come. So it's just a way of saying what we've been talking about. Because then verse 14, it says, third woe is certain to come. So there's still more.
Yes.